This is Word for Word, Public Radio's national speech series from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. The news from Iraq has not been heartening this summer. For instance, a section of northern Iraq that had been spared the daily carnage of Baghdad recently suffered spectacular bombings that left hundreds of people dead. Off the streets and in the halls of government, the political news offers little in the way of optimism. About half of Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki's cabinet members have quit or are boycotting cabinet meetings. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Thomas Ricks put a word to it last year when he titled his book Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq. Ricks doesn't blame the Bush administration alone. He also, as you'll hear this hour, takes military leaders to task for keeping their reservations to themselves. And Congress, says Ricks, hid in the basement for 4 years after 9/11 and didn't play the role it should have in challenging the president. Thomas Ricks says that will have repercussions on the way the American military is used in the future. He made those comments in a speech to the Commonwealth Club of California this month, and it's that speech we'll hear this hour on Word for Word. Thomas Ricks has covered the Pentagon beat for 17 years, first for The Wall Street Journal and currently for The Washington Post. He has won a Pulitzer Prize for his reporting, and his book, Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq, has been a bestseller. Here, then, Thomas Ricks, speaking August 7th at the Commonwealth Club in San Francisco.
What I'd like to talk about is where we are going in Iraq from this point forward. And I want to warn you up front that if you have your antidepressants with you, take them now. Every indication is that the current strategy announced by the president last January is having some moderate tactical effect on the ground in Iraq. In Baghdad. That is to say, security is increasing in some parts of the capital. But remember, when the president announced this counteroffensive last January, the purpose, as stated by the president, was not tactical, it was strategic. And the strategic goal of this counteroffensive was to create a breathing space in which national political reconciliation could occur among Iraqi leaders. At this point, 7 months later, there is no evidence of that succeeding. And in fact, there is growing contrary evidence that it is not succeeding. So, what's going to happen next? I think September will be interesting when General Petraeus comes back and testifies along with Ambassador Crocker, but I don't think it will be dispositive in any way. I don't think it'll really change the debate. I think he'll come back and essentially put lipstick on the pig. He will say, don't pay attention to all those benchmarks we talked about last January. Focus instead on some different trends. And these are genuine trends. Focused on the mixed success we've had, but genuine success, in bringing some security to Baghdad. And look also at the shifting allegiance of some militias and some tribes from al-Qaeda to working alongside United States forces in a marriage of convenience. The people listening most intently to his testimony will be the 21 Republican senators who come up for re-election next year and are probably the people in Washington most dissatisfied with President Bush. But even if, say, another 10 of these senators bolt, giving about 15 Republican senators over to the Democrats on this issue, and giving the Democrats just about a veto-proof majority, I don't think you're going to see the Democratic Party pull the plug on this war. Why? Because they are terrified of being tagged with ending this war as they were tagged with ending the Vietnam War and got blamed for how it ended. So I think they'll hold back. From the Democratic Party's perspective, as with the perspective of many people, this is President Bush's war, and they don't want to take responsibility for it. He started it. Let him finish it. So, what does that mean? I think essentially it means that current policies and strategies will continue for many months, well into 2008. and even perhaps until January 20th, 2009. On Iraq, though, the beginning of wisdom is to understand that we have blown well past the point at which there were good options left. There are no good answers. There is no golden magic bullet that'll solve this situation for us. The question we need to face as a people is, what is the least bad answer available? You can put in front of me any policy option you've heard, and I think it's fairly easy to demonstrate that the potential downside to each one of these is worse than the potential benefits. We are really in a box. The more you look at this, I think the clearer it becomes that the Iraq War is more of a problem for this country than the Vietnam War was. The strategic consequences are likely to be with us longer. We are more strategically vulnerable because of this. We could walk away from Vietnam as a nation. If you were Cambodian, it stunk. If you were a Vietnamese ally of the Americans, it was pretty rough, those 12 to 15 years in the re-education camps. But as a nation, it was only 6 years from the fall of Saigon to the election of Ronald Reagan and people proclaiming that it was mourning in America. It is not going to be mourning in America in dealing with Iraq 5 or 6 years from now. So what happens next year? There are two basic courses that could unfold. If things go unexpectedly well, and if Iraqi political breakthrough occurs, if the level of violence against civilians goes down, the next spring will likely bring the beginning of a U.S. troop drawdown. And sometime in 2009, we'll get down to about 60,000, maybe 80,000 troops. The other course is this. If things go badly, continue to go about as badly as they've been going, or if things go worse, with, say, a nightmare scenario like Iraqi units turning on their American advisors, then next spring will likely bring the beginning of a U.S. troop drawdown. And by sometime in 2009, we'll be down to 60,000 to about 80,000 troops. Why the same outcome? Because the simple fact is there are no replacement troops available for those we have sent out for this current counteroffensive. As they say at the Pentagon, we're out of Schlitz. You could conceivably keep the current number, which I think is now 161 or 162,000, by the way, the highest level we've ever had, I think. You could keep that only if you extended troops out there to 18-month tours of duty. If you did that, you would place an extraordinary new strain on an already stressed military. Already, I am seeing an exodus of the young best and brightest in the military. The captains, the experienced sergeants are just saying, I have done this 3 or 4 or 5 times, and I need to get out. In May, the last time I was in Baghdad, I had breakfast with a smart young Army captain, first in her class at West Point, Rhodes Scholar. And I asked her what her plans were, and she said, I'm getting out next year. And I said, why? And she said, because I no longer have faith in my government. It reminded me, I frequently was reminded of this when I was out in Iraq, of a line from William Butler Yeats, the Irish poet, the best lack all conviction, the worst are full of passionate intensity. I see that back here also, by the way, in the debate over Iraq. So, the real question is, as the troop numbers come down, how far do they come down in 08 and 09? And what will be the mission of the troops we leave there behind, the residual force, the post-surge force, or, as I've heard some people call it, the Hillary force? I think you'll see a movement from the quote-unquote positive goals that the Bush administration established, that is to say, democracy, liberation, and turning Iraq into a beacon of change for the entire Middle East. Remember, they were going to drain the swamp of terrorism. They were going to make stability no longer the goal of U.S. policy, but the target of U.S. policy. As Deputy Defense Secretary Wolfowitz said, if you liked the policy of stability than you like 9/11, because that's what led to it. So the negative policy that I think we'll move to will have, to use the phraseology of Chinese politics, will be, I think, the policy of the three no's. No genocide, no regional war, and no safe haven for al-Qaeda. Now, compared to what we had before, those are fairly minimalist goals. But if you actually look at those, they are extremely difficult to achieve and will be a long, hard, bloody slog if U.S. troops are the people told to achieve them. How do you prevent regional war? Well, you contain a civil war and you let it occur. No one signs up for the U.S. military to stand by while women and children are slaughtered, and that's what that policy would entail. You'd also have to set up refugee catchment areas to prevent millions of refugees from fleeing Iraq and destabilizing the entire region. Well, that's another great mission, capturing women and children, putting them behind barbed wire, and guarding them somewhere out in the deserts of Iraq. That begins to feel to me like the next generation of the PLO growing up inside those, behind that wire. So three final points. First, in military terms, George Bush has already made most of the decisions he is going to make on Iraq. Iraq is rapidly becoming a problem not for him, but for his successor. Second, I don't think the next president is going to be able to get us out of Iraq quickly, and probably not completely either. Now, this is just a prediction, and so it's worth almost nothing. But my gut feeling is we will have U.S. troops in Iraq at the end of the next president's first term, and perhaps at the end of the next president's second term. We have really stepped in this. We can't walk away from it like we could walk away from Vietnam, which ultimately was at the periphery of U.S. interest. This is smack dab in the middle of a region vital to our economy and the world economy. Finally, I don't think it will end well. I think the beginning of wisdom on Iraq is to really to recognize that this is a tragic situation and remember that in Shakespeare's tragedies, there are five acts. I think we're probably only in Act 3. And it's interesting, I can never remember what happens in Act 3 of Shakespeare's plays. But I can remember what happens in Act 4, and Act 5 tends to be very bloody in the tragedies. So you can now see why John Stewart called me Little Miss Sunshine.
Thomas Ricks is author of Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq. He is also a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist for The Washington Post, and he spoke this month at the Commonwealth Club of California. This is Word for Word from American Public Media. I'm Melinda Pencava. After his opening comments, Thomas Ricks took questions for the rest of the hour. The questions came from the audience and were read by Michael Brandis, an attorney in San Francisco who served in the Clinton administration's Defense Department as senior assistant for counterproliferation policy.
Which of the presidential candidates do you think will best manage the Iraq situation? Which would do the worst?
I'm a reporter, so I'm not going to endorse anyone. I will tell you that the candidate who will best deal with Iraq is the candidate with the best sense of tragedy.
Are there any that come to mind?
I would love to see it posed in a debate. I find the debates very frustrating because they don't really go to the character of people, and that's really what you want to know about. I would love to see somebody ask the question, do you consider the nature of life to be tragic? And if not, why not?
Interesting. Here's a question about the Maliki government. Will the Maliki government fall? If so, will that occur before the September report on the status of the surge?
Was it Sam Goldwyn or Daryl Zanuck who said, never make predictions, especially about the future? I'll tell you, discretion really is the better part of wisdom here. Whether it was Goldman or Zanuck, never make predictions, especially about Iraqi politics. The fun, to the extent that there is fun, of covering Iraq is how constantly surprising it is. On the bad days, it feels like it's all inevitable, a slow-motion train wreck that's taking several years. At the same time, every day, Iraq surprises me. I mean, I'm stunned that the outcome of the huge expenditure of blood and treasure by this country is that the most powerful politician in Iraq is the radical Shiite cleric Muqtadir al-Sadr, a supporter of Hezbollah. Your tax dollars at work.
Based on the discussion of General Petraeus in your book, what do you think of his belated assignment in Iraq? Can he bring to bear his insurgency expertise? Is it too late?
General Petraeus is an interesting figure. Petraeus finally got the U.S. military to do what his job won, protect the people. And that doesn't mean sitting around singing kumbaya. It means being present, understanding the situation, and actually sometimes forcing people to make very difficult choices. Are you with us or against us? You can no longer hedge your bets. What's it going to be? How is this going to play out? The question ended correctly, though, is it too little too late? And most people I talked to, most officers I talked to on the ground in Baghdad, thought it was. I do want to add one thought, though. I used to hate going into the Green Zone. It was safer than the rest of Iraq, but it was so detached from reality, I would get a headache from the cognitive dissonance. I'd rather be out in the reality of what the U.S. military calls the Red Zone, which is the rest of Iraq. I didn't find that on this last trip, and it was a really pleasant relief. I was sitting one day talking to one of Petraeus's counterinsurgency advisors, and I thought to myself, not only does this guy have a very good grasp of what's happening out on the streets of Baghdad, he's expressing it better than I could. And that was the first time I'd ever had that feeling in the Green Zone, and I do attribute that to General Petraeus, the new sort of sobriety of assessing and understanding the situation.
In Fiasco, you cite appalling instances of incompetence in the management of the Iraq undertaking. Has the level of competence improved significantly since Fiasco's writing?
Yeah, the level of leadership in Iraq has improved significantly, but there are still some basic structural problems. For example, the principle of unity of command. Have one person in charge of the national effort. This goes back to Gallula. Counterinsurgency is a political act, so you must have a civilian in charge of the political and military effort. We've never had that in Iraq. We've had bifurcated command from day one with no one person in charge. You have a civilian, Ambassador Crocker, and General Petraeus reporting back up their chains of command. And that's not the way you're supposed to do it. So I think there are still basic problems. I also think that the military has escaped a lot of scrutiny in the situation. It's one reason I wrote the book. I think the Bush administration bears the preponderance of blame for mistakes made during the run-up to the war and in producing and insisting on probably what is the worst war plan in American history. I think since April 10th, 2003, I would place the majority of the blame, perhaps 51%, on the shoulders of American generals who failed in the basic military task of understanding the nature of the conflict in which they were engaged, who used good tactics without a strategy, and good tactics without a strategy is like a Ferrari without a steering wheel. Most of all, I blame the generals for refusing to be accountable. There's a real departure from American tradition, and again, this war is a real anomaly in our history. But one of the departures is that generals have not been held accountable for their actions. During World War II, 17 division commanders were relieved. In this war, not only has not any division commander been relieved, no general's been relieved, with the possible exception of Janusz Karpinski, the Army Brigadier, Reserve Brigadier, who commanded it at Abu Ghraib. And it's not clear whether she was relieved for Abu Ghraib or for shoplifting. There's still controversy. When Lieutenant Colonel Paul Yingling, who is until recently was executive officer of the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment, which did very well in its last tour in Iraq, Paul Yingling wrote an essay and published it under his own name, which I took great moral courage. He concluded that a private who loses his rifle is punished more than a general who loses a war in today's army. That's a sobering thought. And one reason this happened, and I'll shut up after this and go to the next question, one reason this happened is Congress was asleep at the wheel. Worse than that, they went and hid in the basement after 9/11 and didn't come out for 4 years. Another aberration in American tradition. Congress abdicated its role as a co-equal branch of government, didn't conduct oversight hearings, and as a result, weakened civilian oversight of the military, which is not just the responsibility of the executive, but also the legislative, and probably undercut military effectiveness by not asking the tough questions the generals were refusing to ask of themselves.
Is the military effectiveness of the decision-making by the generals more a factor of Secretary Rumsfeld?
Like Iraq, Secretary Rumsfeld is a gift that keeps on giving. No, I think that the roots are far deeper. Rumsfeld certainly didn't help it with his abusive management approach. Mm-hmm. But no, there were generals who really thought the approach was wrong and didn't speak up. When they did speak up, of course, they were not invited back to the next meeting. The Bush administration confused questioning the plan with dissent and considered dissent to be disloyalty. So he wound up with a plan based only on best case assumptions, which is not the way to plan your wedding, let alone a war. I think the weaknesses are much deeper than those just of Rumsfeld, though. They really grew out, actually, in many ways, of the Army's really impressive post-Vietnam rebuilding. One of the things the Army lost hold of was strategic thinking. Generals' attitude, and I'm not kidding here, the attitude of a lot of generals was strategic thinking. I have a colonel who does that for me. And in fact, strategic thinking is really the only requirement of a senior general officer. Everything else is supposed to be done by somebody, can be done by somebody else. He has to do that. We lack strategic thinking both in Baghdad and in Washington. And we really dug ourselves a very deep hole before we began to turn this thing around.
Let me turn the questions toward the journalist's responsibility in this adventure in Iraq, as you call it. Here's a question about that. Why did the Washington Post support the war at the beginning? And why are you still providing a forum for the neocons? What's your responsibility?
Zip, zero, and nada. That's the editorial page of the Washington Post, which I have nothing to do with. And it does. It wasn't support of the war initially. They still support the war. When people talk about mistakes made by the media, though, I find, and by the MSM, a term I love, mm-hmm. generally I find what they mean is the New York Times. There's a reason that the two most famous journalists in America right now are probably Judith Miller and Jason Blair. Neither one of them worked at the Washington Post. I had to bring this up with Noam Chomsky when I was talking with him once on a radio show, and he kept on talking about mainstream media this and mainstream media that. And after about the 10th example, I pointed out to him that, Professor Chomsky, you're not talking about the mainstream media. Every example you've offered is from the New York Times. He said, "That's right." Well, in the worldview of certain parts of Cambridge, Massachusetts, there are identical. The New York Times is the received wisdom, and this was his problem. But there's a much bigger world out there. I actually had to go back and read every word the Washington Post published during the run-up to the war. And actually, it was pretty good. We pointed out again and again the doubts, the concerns of generals, the problems that might arise in occupation. And I invite anybody to go back and review the coverage if they doubt it. My actual feeling from somebody in the trenches of this is that the American people weren't interested. that 9/11 caused a panic in this country, stifled debate, and that the information we published about potential problems really never entered into the debate and never became part of the larger questioning about the war, in large part because Congress never acted on any of it, didn't ask questions. And so you'd write stories, they'd go nowhere, no reaction to them. You'd write it again a month later, no reaction to them. Congress simply was not going to engage on this. And this is not a partisan crack. This is true of Democrats as well as Republicans.
Do you think our military today is better prepared to fight the so-called war on terror?
Absolutely not. Our military today is quite strained. It's ironic that the Bush administration came into office saying, "Help is on the way," as Vice President Cheney famously proclaimed to the military in one campaign speech. The military today is quite stressed, quite weakened. And after President Bush campaigned, and I remember this vividly in the presidential debates, after candidate Bush campaigned on no more nation building, he launched the largest nation building project in this country's history. I actually think this is increasing the strategic vulnerability of the country around the world. A lot of people might make miscalculations. They might think that Uncle Sam is tied down in Iraq. And it is true. We really have no more ground forces available right now. And so I worry that North Korea might miscalculate and say, hey, this is the time to act. If we're ever going to do it, whatever we're going to do, let's do it now. You have other countries that might think, you know, they're distracted. I remember asking Defense Secretary Perry once what was the biggest surprise of being Secretary of Defense. And he said that we could only get one thing done at a time in this huge bureaucracy. He said, you really can't do two things at a time. If you're going to do Haiti, you can't deal with the possible Bosnia mission. It just freezes up the bureaucracy. And I think Iraq is so consuming the energies of the State Department, the National Security Council, the Pentagon, that there are other problems that are not going attended to that could really surprise us.
Here's a question from the audience. What is your opinion of the Selective Service, and will there be a draft?
I have no particular opinion on the Selective Service, since the last time I dealt with them is when I had to register. And they gave me a nice number, 330, so I got no complaints. I don't think there will be a draft for a number of reasons. First, even despite the strain it's under, our military today is quite professional. It's not the drafty military of Vietnam. It's one reason our military has hung together through this terrible five-year-long trudge through the deserts and swamps of Iraq. What I mean by that is these are guys who the average corporal is very well trained, understands not only his job but the jobs of the guys on the left and right of him. And I've seen this actually in platoons in Iraq, where a good platoon leader will say, we are going to have no downtime in Iraq, no time for getting bored and grumbling. And they really do it. You come back from a patrol, you rest up, and then you start studying the machine gun, or the medic for the platoon starts training everybody as combat lifesavers. And what happens when you get tired? Well, one platoon had a leader I knew had a footlocker of about 50 good books on military history. And he was determined that every member of his platoon was going to read all those books in the course of a year in Iraq. I've always meant to catch up with him and see whether this plan worked. That literally you'd work, you'd patrol, and you would study military operations until you couldn't move anymore, and then you'd read until you fell asleep. He said, no downtime, that's the policy. And if you didn't want to read or were unable to really read the book, he would find a buddy who would be your reading buddy and would help you through the book. This is a really military in which deep bonds of friendship have been built. There's no, the military term in Vietnam, if there are any Vietnam veterans who remember, is FNG. There's no FNG syndrome. They know who these guys are. Typically, they might have lived next door to them back at Fort Bragg or Fort Benning. They know the wife. They probably saw the kids when they were brought home from the hospital. And when one of these guys gets blown up, it blows a hole in the heart of his squad. And that's the downside of this deep bond, this cohesion these guys have.
Thomas Ricks, Pentagon correspondent for The Washington Post, speaking in early August at the Commonwealth Club of California. This is Word for Word from American Public Media.
Secretary Gates seems to be genuinely committed to finding solutions rather than dodging blame. Do you sense that he will be able to move this administration to a more reasonable course?
It's interesting to remember that Secretary Gates was a member of the Iraq Study Group and then went into the Bush administration, which seemed to promptly ignore the recommendations of the Iraq Study Group. I've been impressed watching his interaction with senior officials. He strikes me as a very good manager, with a low-key manner, and simply by being the anti-Rumsfeld, he gained a lot of credit and favor inside the Pentagon. That said, I've been surprised at how relatively quiet he has been. I counted up recently the number of times President Bush mentioned General Petraeus since January 10th. It was more than 150 times in public speeches. By contrast, he almost never mentions Secretary Gates or, for that matter, Ambassador Crocker. And so I've been a little bit puzzled at Gates' role in all this. It's something I feel as a reporter I need to look more at and figure out quite what's going on. It's a good question. In a month or two, I might have a better answer.
During the Clinton administration, civil-military relations were not good. What does this mean for a Democratic White House in 2008? And I'd like to add, have civilian-military relations, meaning civilian leadership, military relations, improved or declined since the Clinton administration?
The relations between the uniformed military and civilian leadership have been pretty strained over the last several years. The Bush administration has an interesting pattern of saying they defer to generals. I'll listen to the commanders on the ground, President Bush likes to say, and then when they disagree with him, they throw him overboard and get another general. This goes back to General Shinseki, the Army Chief of Staff, telling Congress just before the war that he thought several hundred thousand more troops were needed in the plan for occupying Iraq. And for his pains, by the way, he was doing what he is required to do as a general officer. You must give your personal opinion to Congress when it is asked of you. For his pains, he was put in the icebox for a year and then retired, really having been cut out of discussion with deep alienation between Rumsfeld's office and the Army, which is not a good way to go to war. More recently, we've seen General Casey and General Abizaid blamed for pursuing an ineffective strategy in Iraq. The White House woke up last year and said, hey, this thing ain't working. That must be General Abizaid's fault and General Casey's fault. And so I do wonder a year from now what they'll be saying about General Petraeus. On civil-military relations, my real concern is what I think is an emerging theory inside the military, a narrative, a view that they've been let down. This is kind of a modern version of the old stab in the back. What I hear a lot of officers say in Iraq is, we did everything right out here. Sure, we made some little mistakes, but basically we got it right. But we were betrayed by the politicians. We were undercut by the media. And we were let down by the impatience of the American people. Now, I think they're wrong on all three accounts. The problem with the politicians has not been acts by them. It's been the lack of action by politicians, the departure from the American tradition of active oversight of the conduct of a war. Likewise, I think the military owes a thanks to the media, because the media's coverage of the war in Iraq has been far more accurate than the military's. The media has not been guilty of indulging in over-optimistic assessments. It's interesting, you no longer hear the White House complaining about how the media is not telling all the good news. And you still hear individual soldiers say that, but one reason they do is soldiers may think something is good news if it's not. They saw the schoolhouse built. They didn't see that after they redeployed and a new unit came in, the schoolhouse was looted. They didn't see that the police station was burned down, and that the police chief they befriended was assassinated because they befriended him but failed to protect him. Again and again, things in Iraq that have been described as positive signs are not necessarily, most notably, the Purple Finger elections. What some officials have told me in Baghdad, American officials, is that in retrospect, what those elections did was deepen sectarian differences and perhaps trigger the civil war that broke out in 2006. Why? Because there were no real political parties at the time of the election. And so voting was based on sectarian identification. You voted Sunni or you voted Shiite. And so there was an existing wedge in Iraqi life. The election seems to have driven that wedge deeper. It also may have given the Shiites the sense that once the final election was held in December 2005, that now the gloves could come off because they didn't need to behave anymore. And they could start the real ethnic cleansing of Baghdad, which was one of the major events in Baghdad last year, also very belatedly recognized by the U.S. military. By ethnic cleansing, I mean pushing Sunnis out of the city. You now have a few Sunni enclaves left in Baghdad, but it's a much more Shiite city than it was a few years ago. By the way, though, the policy of putting up walls around those Sunni enclaves, I think, was the right move. For this reason, it made it a lot harder for Shiite death squads to go in and execute Sunnis as a way of forcing them out of the city. Now, was it pretty? No. Did it remind Iraqis of the Israeli occupation? You bet. That said, as one officer said to me, a tourniquet isn't pretty either, but you put it on in order to protect the patient, to help the patient not die. And it's a harsh decision, but you make it because you're in a crisis.
Do the countries surrounding Iraq share the Bush administration's view that they have a stake in avoiding a potential collapse when the U.S. pulls out?
One of the questions I get, and especially in San Francisco, which seems very fond of UN-based solutions. I admire your faith in the UN. I don't share it. Is why can't we get the regional parties to come into Iraq, intervene, send troops in, and help us out? And my answer is, well, there is one country that's sending troops into Iraq. It's called Iran. We don't have a lot of friends in the region right now. And I think a lot of countries, and I suspect the Saudis share this a bit, aren't that upset to see Uncle Sam get his comeuppance. They feel we act arrogantly and in disregard of their advice. And now they feel that we are reaping what we sowed. And they're kind of happy to see us taken down a peg or two. Other countries kind of like the fix we're in. And I think most of all, Iran. Every time we dial up the pressure on Iran on their nuclear weapons program, they can dial up the violence in Iraq. They can kill American troops. It would be much easier for us to deal with Iranian nuclear ambitions if we didn't have troops in Iraq. This is just one more of the opportunity cost of an ill-considered invasion. Like I say, it's a gift that keeps on giving. So I don't see a regional solution. What I do see is the next president will have a diplomatic window of opportunity of perhaps 6 to 9 months when other countries want to demonstrate they weren't anti-American, they were just anti-Bush. We're not going to get anybody to come in and bail us out on the ground militarily. The UN doesn't do what we need done in Iraq. The UN sends in peacekeepers who are no good when there's no peace to keep. So what the UN might do, and we're already seeing a little bit of this come out of Ban Ki-moon, is get together a regional conference that might in some ways help out a bit. But right now I don't see any regional answer bailing us out at all.
Here are a series of questions dealing with Israel. So, what role did the Israeli lobby play in all this? Can Israel force a U.S. attack on Iran? Can we withdraw from Iraq without getting out of Israel first?
I don't understand the last question.
It's not my question.
Okay. I think this is one of the great myths that has grown up, along with, by the way, the media bashing. If only the media had told us. No, you guys got told. The American people failed on this one. The other great myth is Israel somehow drove us to war. And I actually think this smacks a bit of anti-Semitism, because, oh, the neocons, you know, they're Jewish, and that sort of whispered comment you hear. I don't see any evidence of that. The fact of the matter is that Israel didn't see Saddam Hussein as a threat. They properly saw him as a paper tiger, which is what he was. He had been smashed up in a war with Iran. What was left of his military was pummeled in the 1991 war by the United States. And what was left after that was weakened through years of sanctions and American imposition of no-fly zones. I actually think the reason he claimed to have weapons of mass destruction is because he had nothing else left. And this was how he could fend off countries in the region and at least, you know, deter them possibly.
What precisely should the U.S. have done militarily when bin Laden was still in Tora Bora? Would it have been feasible to have captured bin Laden then?
Tora Bora was the big mistake. And once again, General Tommy Franks, man. Franks could have put troops up there and probably could have cut off the escape routes of a lot of members of al-Qaeda. And we could have avoided a lot of problems. But he didn't put troops up there. He didn't understand his enemy or his allies. He was surprised when Afghan militiamen let him down, as if these guys were unpatriotic. They're Afghan militiamen. They're loyal to their tribe. What did you expect? Tommy Franks' M.O. didn't have a plan B. So he was operating on false assumptions and then didn't have any alternative available when those assumptions were proven wrong. I think it really was the single big mistake of the war and could have been done quite differently in Afghanistan.
How successful has been the use of private contractors for tasks previously handled by the military?
I think historians will look back on the use of private contractors and, to use the proper term, mercenaries. I think historians will look back on this as one of the really huge mistakes that really is not even recognized adequately now. The reason we're using all these contractors, 20,000 people whose jobs is to provide security, that is, have their fingers on triggers, and another perhaps 180,000 other contractors who are doing things like cooking food, the reason we have all those people out there is our military wasn't big enough for the job it was given. Now, that's an excuse maybe in 2003, but we have now been fighting this longer than we fought World War II, during which we raised, 97 divisions? And here, we didn't increase the size of the military at all, again, because of best-case planning. Remember the original war plan for Iraq, and I am not making this up, as Dave Barry would say, had us down to 30,000 troops by September 2003. We are not there yet, folks, and we won't be for a long time. So we threw contractors in there, and we didn't even think about the really poisonous effect they have in the battlefield. They're not subject, or at least for many years, were not subject to U.S. law, nor were they really accountable to Iraqi law. Iraqis recognized this and deeply resented it. I remember one day February 06, a year and a half ago, I was walking out of our post house in Baghdad. And by the way, Washington Post reporters do not live in the green zone. It's one of the myths that reporters all live in the green zone. We have a house out in the red zone. And I was walking out of the house one day, and underneath my body armor, I was wearing a long-sleeve black T-shirt. And Mohammed, our security chief, who reviews you as you leave the house, said, "Go inside and change your shirt." And I said, "How come?" And he said, "Because you look like a security contractor, and it increases your risk." These guys also were not out there to serve the American interest. They were there to serve a contract. What's the difference? Well, a soldier knows he needs to go out and execute his mission, but he also needs, he goes out in uniform representing the United States of America, and he has that flag right here to remind him. The mercenaries don't have that responsibility, don't have that mission in mind. Their job is to execute a contract. And if the contract says, keep this person you're a bodyguard for alive, you can do that at the expense of everything else. Driving on the sidewalks of Baghdad, not uncommon. Shooting at cars that get too close without warning, not uncommon. And even killing people. I know a Marine Colonel, T.X. Hammes, who told me about contractors pointing a weapon at him because they thought he was getting too close to the principal they were guarding. So I think we'll look back and recognize that this is a huge mistake that enormously complicated our presence in Iraq and one that should not be repeated.
What would you suggest for U.S., Iraq, and Middle East foreign policy?
I would suggest reading tragedies. Now, honestly, I'm not joking. I've been going back. I've been reading a lot of Greek tragedy, also a lot of ancient Greek history, reading Herodotus. One of the great classics is Xenophon's Anabasis, an account of a retreat out of Iraq by 10,000 Greek mercenaries. They started southeast of Baghdad after they were part of a Persian civil war, and they marched up the east bank of the Tigris, past Crete, through Nineveh, now known as Mosul, across Turkey into the Black Sea. There's a lot of ancient wisdom I've been reading. Remember, we're walking around there, the lands of the Bible. Jonah preached in the streets of Mosul. Ezekiel was from southern Iraq. We have really stepped into the middle of a lot of history here that we didn't understand as a nation.
Is it ultimately the fault of a flawed policy or bad leadership for the quagmire we are in?
Yes.
That was too easy.
It is too easy. It deserves a better answer. Obviously, this is unprovable because it's a hypothetical about history. Was an insurgency inevitable? That is, was this thing doomed from the outset because of strategic flaws and misunderstandings from before we ever went into Iraq? Or could the occupation have been handled in such a way that we wouldn't have had this mess in our hands? I can't prove it in either way. I tend to think that we did help create the insurgency, that some resistance was inevitable, but not of this scope, intensity, and duration. The evidence for this is that the British in 1920 had an insurgency on their hands in Iraq, and they put it down in 6 months. Now, it was a different sort of insurgency with different actors. Not entirely different, though. If you go back and read the memoirs of Lieutenant General Haldane, the British commander, he's constantly bellyaching about this Shiite cleric named Sadr. No joke. Decisions we made, policies of Ambassador Bremer and tactics of U.S. commanders helped create the insurgency. The three basic problems facing any new insurgency are recruiting, arming, and financing. By dissolving the Iraqi military and by declaring debathification, the rule of the land, we created a leadership structure and tens of thousands of potential recruits who knew how to use weapons and were told they had no jobs and probably no future in Iraq. Arms, we didn't have enough troops to guard these giant arms depot. I remember being told there was one east of Crete that was 4 miles by 4 miles, about almost the size of Washington, D.C. Bunker after bunker after bunker. And we didn't have the troops, and we had dissolved the Iraqi military, so it would have had leakage, but it couldn't guard them either. We also had commanders who had been told that those bunkers probably contained chemical weapons. I remember asking a Marine battalion commander, why didn't you blow up that weapons depot? You knew it's there. And he said, sir, I didn't want to set up a toxic plume that could have killed a whole city. Again, delusions about weapons of mass destruction, a gift that keeps on giving. Because of those delusions, because the weapons dumps were not destroyed, American troops have been killed by some of those weapons.
If, as you contend, the outlook is not good no matter what, why shouldn't we remove the bulk of troops ASAP and use some of the money saved for rebuilding our relationships with other countries?
That's a very good question. The burn rate in Iraq right now is $3 billion a week. That's B as in boy, billion. Imagine this alternative universe where we take 1 week of spending, $3 billion, and we give it to the government of Pakistan and say, spend it on education, no strings attached. Make teachers respected people, nice cars, nice houses. And we do that the following year. Here's another $3 billion. And the following year. And then year four, you say, you want your $3 billion? Give us Osama bin Laden. I think that would have been a novel, but perhaps effective approach. Pulling out is, I think, something that needs to be seriously debated. I've heard officers in Iraq make the argument that a civil war in Iraq, a full-scale, genocidal, cover your eyes and go hide in the basement and don't watch CNN civil war, is inevitable. And so they argue, all we are doing is postponing the inevitable and having Iraqi civilians die, American troops die, and American money wasted. So pull back and let them knock themselves out. I asked a UN official about this, and he said, that's interesting because that's condoning a war crime. Under the law, international law, you occupy a country. You're responsible for its security. You can't just get bored and walk out of the movie. The movie keeps going. So I think it is a real dilemma. Obviously, we don't know whether a large-scale civil war is inevitable. I was really struck, though. One of Petraeus' counterinsurgency advisors made this argument. Just because you invade a country stupidly doesn't mean you should leave it stupidly. So he said the questions we need to ask is, are there ways to mitigate the damage we've done? Are there ways to draw down your presence in such a way as to lessen the likelihood of extreme violence rather than increase it? Make that the measure of your actions. Can we tamp this thing down? Can we contain it? Can we not exacerbate existing problems? And he said that should be the lodestar of our policy.
Thomas Ricks, Pulitzer Prize-winning Pentagon correspondent for The Washington Post and author of the book Fiasco, The American Military Adventure in Iraq. He spoke to the Commonwealth Club of California in San Francisco on August 7th. If you missed part of today's speech by Thomas Ricks, or if you would just like to hear it again, you may visit our website at wordforword.org. There, you may also subscribe to our free weekly podcast and listen to any of our previous programs, including speeches by Karl Rove, Bill Clinton, and former Secretary of State Colin Powell, all at wordforword.org. Thanks for joining us for this edition of Word for Word. For American Public Media, I'm Melinda Penkava.
Word for Word is produced by Curtis Gilbert and Larissa Anderson, with associate producer Patty Ray Rudolph. And the technical director is Sam Keenan.
American Public Media.